Hello, I'm Charles Gitonga, and here is what's coming up for you on this edition of Focus on Africa. Gambia is facing a shortage in medicines, which the government attributes to a long and slow procurement process. How did Gambia get here? And despite being more tech-savvy than others, a report says Gen Zs are more vulnerable to cyber attacks.
This overconfidence phenomenon is something that we pick up on the continent as well, is that the younger generations generally are concerned about cybercrime and they are aware of it, but they think it doesn't really happen to them, or they know what to do when in fact they actually don't. And that's a problem with the digitally native users in general.
It's Monday, February 17th. First, we go to Addis Ababa. That's the sound of delegates arriving for the African Union Summit, which was held over the weekend. The gathering of African leaders meeting in the Ethiopian capital city of Addis Ababa discussed a number of issues, among them the crisis in the Democratic Republic of Congo and who will lead the organization. Djibouti's Foreign Minister, Mahmoud Ali Youssouf, was elected as the new chairman of the African Union's Executive Commission. He defeated Kenya's veteran opposition leader, Raila Odinga, in the race to succeed Musa Faki Mahamat. Here's what Nur Mohamed Sheikh, an advisor to the chairman's campaign team, had to say about his appointment.
We are very happy that he won deservedly. He's been getting congratulatory messages from across the African continent and globally, including from the Secretary General of the United Nations. Muhammad Ali is widely regarded as a candidate who exemplifies the highest standards of efficiency, competence, and integrity. As one of Africa's longest-serving foreign ministers, his depth of diplomatic expertise was acknowledged, but generational considerations also played a role, reflecting the aspirations of the continent's citizens for a younger, dynamic leader to drive the Union's agenda forward.
Mahmoud Ali Youssouf will now serve a four-year term. His election was overshadowed by fears about the crisis in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where Rwandan-backed M23 rebels reached the city center of Bukavu in South Kivu province. At a news conference on the sidelines of the African Union summit in Addis Ababa, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres warned that this latest offensive could spark a regional conflict.
In the Democratic Republic of the Congo, the Congolese people have been suffering yet again from a brutal cycle of violence. And the fighting that is raging in South Kivu as a result of the continuation of the M23 offensive threatens to push the entire region over the precipice. There is no military solution. The deadlock must end, the dialogue must begin, and the sovereignty and territorial integrity of the DRC must be respected.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. The AU was launched officially in 2002 and succeeded the Organization of African Unity, founded in the early 60s. Its main objectives were to rid Africa of any vestiges of colonialism and apartheid and promote unity among its 55 member nations. But it has come to be regarded as toothless and ineffective. In 2016, African countries recognized the need for the African Union to change, but many reforms still remain to be implemented. I've been speaking to Andrews Atta Asamoah, who is from the Institute for Security Studies in Addis Ababa and has expertise on the African Union.
I think for this particular summit, the most important points are really about the leadership elections, which started not just with the vote at the level of the Assembly of Heads of State, but the choice of commissioners, as well as the choice of the new chair of the AUC. I think those are pretty much the most important, in my view, defining when it comes to the politics around the summit.
So, no doubt there are many challenges on the continent. What do you think this leadership should be focusing on?
At the moment, within Africa, we are seeing a rise in the trend of insecurity, both existing threats and new emerging ones. If you look at the Sahel, violent extremism seems to be on the rise in various countries. The continent is struggling with the choices of the coup leaders that we've witnessed in recent times. The trend of democracy seems to be, you know, reducing in terms of consolidation of performance. We are also seeing various threats all over the continent, as well as economic issues. And if you look at the dynamics of how external positioning affecting continental dynamics, you will notice that even emerging powers are now extending their spheres of influence into parts of the continent, as well as, you know, the role of private military, external private military actors on the continent, and the changing nature of, you know, big power relations in the continent. And so these are all a mix of things that the new leadership will have to grapple with.
But I'm wondering whether there is an economic angle to this as well. We've seen, if we are to bring in, for example, what's happening in the US with an America that is looking pretty much inwards and rewriting its agreements with pretty much everyone else out there. I don't know if these are things that the Commission would be thinking about.
So, I mean, war is economics, because even the elements of war, the weapons of war themselves, are all connected, you know, to the cycle of economic, or if you like, changing of hands. So war is business on many fronts. So the insecurity dynamics we have on the continent, apart from those who are profiting from, you know, the insecurity itself, there are dimensions of, you know, economic variables playing a role in the onset of conflicts and how they play out in a very dynamic way. That is one thing. The element around, you know, the what the US is doing and how that will have an impact, I think the leaders will have to look at it, because the cessation or the freezing of American aid, for instance, has a huge implication, because there are countries that depend on such aid to respond to humanitarian situations. There are dimensions of Africa's challenges that these provide answers for. So once all these are being frozen, the immediate impact will have to be worked on at the regional and continental level whilst member states try to fix and find lasting solutions. So it's coming at a time that there are practical implications of these changes which they will have to meet and respond to.
Andrews, the African Union is often described as being toothless and ineffective. What do you think of that? Is it fair?
Two things. I think in one way, one can say it is fair if you look at the potential the institution carries versus what the institution delivers. That net effect of inability to respond to the needs and to stop, you know, the raging conflicts we have in the Sahel, the issues around coup d'etats, the trouble in Southern Africa, around Mozambique, and issues in all other parts of the continent. If you look at those, you will say, you know, it's lacking the teeth to bite. And the fact that in some cases it appears their bluff is being called. If you look at the way the coup makers in recent times are positioning themselves, from that perspective, you can say, yes, they are lacking, you know, the capacity to respond. But if you put all the variables, both historical context, and you put all the issues that makes the elements and the ability of a diplomatic entity like the AU to be effective into the equation, I will say that you have an affinity to understand where the weaknesses are and begin to appreciate even the little the AU delivers, understanding that within the international system, multilateral institutions are as effective as their members make them be. And so defining the AU as a weak and toothless dog essentially defines the lack of consensus on the continent and the inability of Africa's countries to come together and project strong political will in the interest of the women and children who are living on the vulnerable side of the continent we are in. So in a way, it's not all about how weak the AU is. In a way, it's about how strong we've made it, or how weak
we've made the AU to be.
Andrews, what is so frustrating from where you stand about the African Union as it is today?
I think the frustration has to do with the inability of an institution that has the capacity to do more, the inability of that institution to express or project far beyond what we needed to do, and increasingly holding on to the fact of the existence of these weaknesses as a way of explaining away its inability to do more is frustrating. Because if you go back even into the Organization of African Unity days, OAU days, and you look at the very variables that made the OAU ineffective, it had to do with member states not yielding power to the commission or the secretariat. It had to do, second, with funding issues. And thirdly, the member states holding on to their sovereignty and then keeping out the collective, which is the organization, when they thought it worked in their favor. We are seeing these ugly monsters show up again, playing in different ways, in different forms. But essentially, the money issue is still there. The lack of member states yielding strength to the AU Commission is still there. And the popping up and the selective use of sovereignty is also still there. So you ask yourself, are we willing to move beyond our weaknesses to become strong? Or we are explaining and finding reasons to explain away our weaknesses? And while this is happening on one side, the world is changing, and all the variables that we thought we could use in our favor are fast shifting, from global governance to multilateral alignments to superpower relations to superpower projection of power. It is time for Africa not to do business as usual because the context has changed.
Andrews Atta Asamoah from the Institute for Security Studies in Addis Ababa. There is a shortage of medicines in the Gambia, which is impacting people in need of critical drugs. The country's health minister, Dr. Ahmadou Lamine Samatei, said delays in importing medicines in the country are currently caused by the slow procurement process. The process itself involves several steps, which includes paperwork, approvals, advertisements, evaluations, and contract signing. This can take up to 6 months. You may remember the devastating story when around 70 children, younger than 5, died in the Gambia of acute kidney injuries between July and October 2022. That's after they consumed one of 4 cough syrups made by Indian company called Maiden Pharmaceuticals. In October 2023, the World Health Organization linked the deaths to the syrups, saying it had found unacceptable levels of toxins in the medicines. A Gambian parliamentary panel also concluded, after investigations, that the deaths were the result of the children ingesting the syrups. Both Maiden Pharmaceuticals and the Indian government have denied this, with India saying the syrups complied with quality standards when tested domestically. Now, since this incident, the Gambia brought in stricter regulation. But how is this impacting the availability of medicines today, and how severe is the problem? I've been speaking to Mahawa Njaye from the Pharmaceutical Association of Gambia Importers.
Since the emergence of the AKI, the acute kidney injuries, back in 2022, the Medicine Control Agency came with some stringent regulatory measures in place to control the importation of substandard and contaminated medicine in the Gambia. This includes the registration of all pharmaceutical products manufactured in India. And they also put a pre-shipment analysis process in place with an independent agency in India called Control. And also the registration process of pharmaceutical product in the Gambia takes time. It takes up to 3 to 6 months. And before any importer is allowed to import any pharmaceutical product from India, he is expected to register these products before they can be shipped from India.
So it's basically procurement delays, but has it always taken 3 to 6 months for the process of importing medicines into the country to be complete?
No, some process take some time, but some wouldn't take that long. But the official time limit given to us is 3 to 6 months, depending on the volume of the dossiers or application for registration they have at hand.
So let me ask you, and probably speaking to someone outside of Gambia who may not be familiar with the local processes, what are the specific steps that really contribute to these prolonged timelines for procuring drugs?
It's just the stringent regulations that are in place. Like, for instance, before, when I used to import medicine from the Gambia, all I need to do is to provide invoice, certificate of analysis, packing list, and other supporting documents, and then ship my container to the Gambia. But now I will need at least 2 months or 3 months to register a product. It can go up to 6 months for me to register a product before I can even think of bringing it into the Gambia. So this constitutes a delay for procurement.
For context, Mr. Njai, how long was it taking before?
1 month, 15 days, or highest 2 months, because there was no, you know, registration process involved, and there was also no pre-shipment analysis also in place in India.
So what I want to know is if the country is running out of essential medicines because of these delays that you're talking about. What's the situation on the ground, the impact of this?
The healthcare professionals in the Gambia prescribe based on the healthcare needs of the patient. So sometimes if we receive a prescription from a prescriber and the medicine is out of stock, we will indicate the best alternative or substitute and ask the patient to return to the prescriber. Sometimes the prescriber might change the prescription. Otherwise, the patient will have no option but to travel to a neighboring country like Senegal to source this medicine.
I'm wondering if this shortage is leading to some black market activity. Have you seen anything of the sort?
Actually, since the Gambia suffered from the acute kidney injury that led to the death of 71 people in the Gambia, the Medicine Control Agency has strengthened their regulatory and enforcement function. They have close collaboration with other security apparatus, such as customs, police, and other intelligence agencies. All this is to curb the illegal importation and distribution of pharmaceutical products in the Gambia. They have also stationed inspection personnel at the borders and airport as checkpoints. But since we are surrounded by Senegal, one can't rule out the possibility of having few that will escape them.
And what types of medicines are most affected by these delays?
Most of the medicines that are affected are the essential medicines like these vaccines like the anti-rabies, anti-snake bite, and even the basic medicines, sometimes they are affected because even to bring a paracetamol, you need to register the product. And the registration process is the same for all pharmaceutical products. And also for products that we are sourcing from Europe or America, there's also a process called listing. Before, what we used to do is we provide our invoices as far as it's coming from Europe, and we can easily import them from Europe. Before this product can be imported into the Gambia, the product has to be listed in the first place. And if the product is listed, then one can provide the documents necessary for importation clearance permit. That is, you have to provide the certificate of origin of the product, invoice, packing list, certificate of compliance, and all of these documents have to be submitted after the products are listed. And this also is a process. There's a back and forth. Sometimes it can take 2 days to 3 days before it can be listed. Then you can submit your importation clearance permit application.
And are there fears that, you know, the situation there, if you talked about vaccines being delayed and other medicines as well, are there concerns on how this might impact on public health?
Of course, there are concerns. Like, for instance, if a person is in need of a vaccine to save life and this is not available, of course, that is enough to explain the concern that we are all facing. And there are also some situations where a woman is in labor and is in need of anti-D, the immunoglobulin vaccine. And this is something that is very important when a woman is in labor and is in need of this vaccine. And also considering the volume that we procure of this vaccine, sometimes to register them becomes a challenge. because these are actually vaccines that we buy in very small volume. And manufacturers, they will not consider the volume that we buy from them. That is enough for them to consider giving us the documents necessary for registration.
So what needs to be done then to bring solutions to this?
Maybe ask for minimum documentation for their registration or give a waiver for the importation of these products without necessarily the need to register them or for them to pass pre-shipment analysis.
Could you clarify if this just affects the medicines coming out of India or is it in general from wherever they might be coming from?
Actually, for those that we are bringing from Europe, we have a list of countries considered to be countries with stringent regulatory authorities. And we are allowed to bring products that are manufactured from these countries as far as we can list them. But these products, most of them are manufactured in India. So this is why there are products that are coming from India.
Mahawa Njaye from the Pharmaceutical Association of Gambia Importers. Let's take a listen to this testimony sent in by Amy Bajo in The Gambia.
I am a kidney transplanted patient. I have done my transplant in India, that is in 2021. I take these immune suppressants twice a day. That is the mycophen, tacrolimus, and prednisolone. And also my BP medicine, that is the metoprolol. Not having these medicines on time, meaning my kidney, that is the kidney that has been donated to me by my mother, it's going to fail. My body is going to reject it. So it really makes me feel so scared because anybody who knows dialysis knows it's not an easy thing. The time that you expect the medicines to arrive, they won't arrive at that time. And you'll be in your risk period hoping that your transplant will not fail. I know I'm not the only person who goes through this. There was a time that I don't have my medicine on time. That is, I can say a week before last, I was admitted at the main hospital in Banjul. I lost blood through stool and I became anemic. So I went to the hospital. They said sepsis also was part of it. So I had to be there for 6 good days. Then later I was discharged. Now at home. Yeah, I'm just hoping and praying that it won't run out again.
This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service. Do you use the same password for both your personal and work accounts? You are not alone if you do. A 2022 survey found that nearly half of Gen Z prioritize cybersecurity on their personal devices more than their work devices. It also revealed that Gen Z employees are more likely than older generations to reuse passwords and ignore important IT updates. We asked some Gen Z workers about their experiences. Here is what they had to say.
I was born in 2001. I do not use the same password for my personal and professional account. I like to keep my personal things personal and just separate that from work.
I was born in 1988. I use the same password for one of my professional accounts because it's easier to understand.
I was born in the year 2000. Trying to download something online, I was trying to find an ebook. It was really hard to find, so I ended up at a sketchy website. And instead of downloading the PDF came as a zip file. And when I opened up the zip file, there were software attached to it that just copied some information from my laptop. But I think nothing terrible came of it, sure.
Born between 1997 and 2012, Gen Z has grown up surrounded by smartphones, tablets, and social media. Experts say their digital upbringing has made them more confident online, but it has also left them more vulnerable to cyber threats, especially with the rise of AI-powered attacks. In fact, 72% of Gen Z workers admit to clicking on suspicious links at work, far more than older generations. So, why is a generation known for being tech-savvy still so susceptible to cyber risks? I spoke with cybersecurity expert Anna Collard.
I think something that we have to keep in mind is that they might be aware of some of the security issues, but there's that attitude of, you know, they don't really care about it. And that's that related to sort of overconfidence principles, also called the Kruger-Dunning principle, or cognitive bias, really, where it's more dangerous to think that you know more about something that you do, if you know what I mean. And bringing it back to the continent, like if we look at Africa, we actually run a survey every year since 2019 across 8 African countries, including Kenya. And this overconfidence phenomenon is something that we pick up on the continent as well, is that the younger generations generally are aware of, or they are concerned about cybercrime and they are aware of it, but they think it doesn't really happen to them, or they know what to do when in fact they actually don't. And that's a problem with the, it's called them the digitally native users in general.
So the study that you alluded to that was done by Ernst & Young, it was done in America, we must say, but it said that Gen Zs prioritize cybersecurity on their personal devices, but are more relaxed about it at the workplace. What do you think that's the case?
Yeah, it depends on your workplace culture and policy enforcement, I suppose. If you're working in a company that's very strict about it, you'll see the same compliance across both generations. But it's something that I can confirm as well, having worked with a South African insurance company where they also did, and it's quite a large, one of the biggest ones in the country, where they also did a comparison between the older generation and then the Gen Z alphas, etc. And they confirmed as well that the riskiest users, in terms of, when I say, you know, it's not that they necessarily on purpose violate the security procedures, but they make mistakes like clicking on phishing links much more so than the older generation. One reason for that could be that they've just haven't grown up with emails. You know, they've grown up with social media and instant messaging rather than emails. And then email is actually a new kind of environment to them. So they haven't really sort of learned how to be vigilant in an email-based scenario, which a lot of the corporates or big organizations still use.
You've encountered an error.
One can wonder if this relaxed approach to cybersecurity, does this put the Gen Z and also the organizations that they work for at greater risk of cyber attacks, especially in Africa, where we do report of these attacks on almost a daily basis, to be honest?
Yes, definitely. I mean, it doesn't matter which data breach report you look at or which kind of cyber extortion report you look at. It very often, in fact, between 70 and 90% of the cases, these incidents start off with a human doing something that they shouldn't be doing. And let's be honest, it's also because the criminals are specifically targeting the human element. So that human risk factor is definitely something that needs to be taken serious. And particularly in Africa, where we are dealing with a young population, you know, a younger population and embracing technology, but we have to make sure that they are equipped with the right knowledge and the tools as well in protecting themselves and the organizations that they work for.
Let's talk about AI, which is not a human element. And what role do you think that AI-powered threats play in exploiting this attitude, this laxed approach online?
I mean, AI so far has not really introduced major new techniques or tactics in the cyber crime ecosystem, but they've definitely made the existing threats way more scalable, more efficient, more automated. So you will still see social engineering as being one of the major threat vectors. And when I say social engineering, that is the hacking of the human mind. Only that with AI, it can be done at a much bigger scale and much more sophisticated. You know, like in the past, you could tell someone, you know, look at spelling errors, like bad language. Now that's no longer the case because any criminal can use ChatGPT or whatnot to create a good sounding phishing email. And also with the deepfake and those kind of things, it's something that's really scary in terms of the impersonation attack, the kind of human likeness that they can use to scam and manipulate people, both in cyber attacks as well as in disinformation and misinformation campaigns, which is another massive problem on the continent.
Something you mentioned about use of passwords and reusing them across devices, personal and professional accounts. It sounds like almost tech 101. The first thing you are told is do not use your password across devices and across accounts. What do you think is driving this?
To be honest, like as a human, I'm a cyber psychologist. And I've been in cybersecurity for 20 years, and passwords are the bane of my existence, of everybody's existence. It really is difficult to remember long passwords, and you should have like 16 digits nowadays, right? To make it safe enough. It's not possible for a human brain to remember unique 16-digit long passwords across all the different accounts. I mean, we have about 300 accounts or something. However, that's where the younger generation is maybe more likely to embrace technology to help with that. So a password manager, for example, can really be useful and help with the management of all these hundreds of passwords that we're supposed to keep on top of. So it's just human nature that if you don't use a password manager, what ends up happening is that they either reuse the same password across the accounts, or, which is also a really bad idea, they write it onto like a Excel spreadsheet or a Word document on their computer, or they use the sort of in the browser saving feature, both of which are really bad ideas because that's the first place where the criminals will look at when they do happen to exploit your machine or get onto your machine.
What do you think then organizations need to do, especially when we talk about that intergenerational gap where you have one set of employees that are very cautious about this and you have another that is not as cautious about it?
I think the first step is to accept the fact that we are dealing with different groups of people that also appreciate different communication style. And it's not just across generations, it's also different cultures, even within departments, even personality types, right? Some people prefer to watch a video, others would like to read document. So it's important that in your awareness campaigns that you sort of customize your content or the messages in a way that it is consumable by different audiences, and also that you target this to those specific audiences. It's important to keep that message top of mind. The best way, to be honest, of doing it in an organization is through, we call it phishing simulations, where you really, in our case, for example, we get one phishing email every week. So that really keeps me sort of vigilant because I don't want to do training again. So keeping people reminded of the fact, or creating habits, like healthy digital habits, that will help them to keep the company safe, as well as actually the online safety at home in their families.
Cybersecurity expert Anna Collard. Focus on Africa was produced by Patricia Whitehorn, Sunita Nahar and Nyasha Michelle in London, and Blessing Adereba in Lagos. Carney Sharp was a senior journalist in charge, and Philip Bull, our technical producer. Our editors are Andrea Lombard and Alice Mudengi. I'm Charles Gitonga. Speak again soon.